Hi, welcome to another Poetica podcast from RN. I'm Justine Sloan-Lees, and in this podcast, we're meeting Scottish poet John Burnside, who was a guest at the 2013 Melbourne Writers Festival. John started out his working career as a computer software engineer, but since giving that up, he's published 14 books of poetry, as well as novels and short stories. He's also written two memoirs. The first, A Lie About My Father, tells of his early relationship with his father, who he describes as a fantasist, a morose, threatening drinker who was quick with his hands. John Burnside's second memoir, Waking Up in Toy Town, follows his struggles in his 20s and 30s when he tries to leave behind a life of drugs, drink and mental illness to make a new life in the suburbs. John's now Professor of Creative Writing at St Andrews University, and in 2012 he won the T.S. Eliot Prize for his collection of poems, Black Cat Bone. We'll be hearing him read from that collection and talking to producer Fiona Kroll.
I was marking a stack of essays on Frank O'Hara, and each had a wiki paragraph to say who Jenny was and who was Billie Holiday. And didn't we think for a moment of crushing his feet so he couldn't return to the house at Halloween? For as long as the birds take flight or Lucille Ball lights up the screen. The random acts of love, the venial sins. It's never what we wanted, ever after. Hyena. Like something out of Bruegel, maned in white and hungry like the dark, the bat ears pricked, the face a grey velour, more cat than dog, more caracal than fanilook or civet. Here is the patron beast of all who love the night, waking at dusk to anatomy's blunt hosanna, the carrion daylight broken and picked to the bone, while the radio dance band fades to a slow alleluia, and far at the back of the mind, the perpetual frenzy, eye, teeth and muzzle coated with blood and matter, as every mouth digs in for fair or foul, a giggle in the bushes, then a shudder.
In your collection, Black Cat Bone, there's references throughout that book of the Flemish Renaissance painter, Bruegel. Can you talk a bit about the qualities of Bruegel, especially in relation to the poem Hyena?
It's interesting because we see him as being the painter of peasant life, the painter of ordinary people. Their grotesquery, often the characters are doing ridiculous things or caught up in things that make them look grotesque. And yet there's a deep humanity and a kind of forgiving quality. He sees humanity in its limits, but also sees the possibilities. He also sees the strangeness in all of us, and that's something that I've always been interested in. The fact that sometimes we can be aware of ourselves as strange, we suddenly see ourselves as remarkable, mysterious, strange creatures. And Bruegel sees that, I think, in his people, in his characters. There's a quality of light and colour in his work that I don't see anywhere else. Contemporaries have something similar, but there's a depth in the colour. And I often have dreams and I wake up and I think it's like a Bruegel dream, So he's been a huge influence on the way I think about the world, not just about art or writing, but just the way I see things. Again, it's the sense of that kind of like dark, sinister character coming out of the darkness, almost half animal, half something else. The hyena poem actually combines the qualities of two different kinds of hyena. I can't tell you how many letters I got from people who are obviously hyena nuts, who wrote to me and said, "Oh, but you've mixed up the two different kinds of a hyena." I said, "Yeah, it's on purpose." But there are people out there who are really dedicated to the hyena as a kind of totem animal, and I kind of get that. I really do, because there's something special about them. Whenever I go to the zoo, the first place I go to is the hyena enclosure.
We like to sort of get into the mind of the poet and find out a bit about your writing space and process. Where is it that you write? Are you on the run or in the shower? Paint a picture.
When I started out writing poetry, I kind of, you know, took it up a little bit lightly, I suppose, and almost like a hobby. And I used to think that you could sit in with a blank sheet of paper and sit there and think of a brilliant line and write it down and then think of another brilliant line. That doesn't work for me. So I usually, I'm composing when I'm on the hoof, really, walking. I do a lot of walking. And when I'm out walking, I don't take a pen or pencil with me. I don't take any paper. If something memorable stays in my head until I get back from the walk, then it's probably worth writing down. And that was the kind of basic idea when I started writing, you know, poems that I started to keep. It's very different from writing prose. Prose I write at the desk. I sit there and write it and rewrite it and rewrite it. But poetry, I compose, you could say, in my head.
Can you take us into a poem that you've done recently, perhaps an unpublished poem or one that's hot off the press?
I've written a lot about my father. My father and I had a very troubled relationship, quite violent at times, and I didn't think I was going to write about him again. I wrote a whole book about our relationship in prose, and I'd written a few poems about him. But this book returns to him, and there's a pair of poems that I put together. One was based on reading J.A. McCulloch's book on the religion of the ancient Celts, talking about how if there's a warrior that had died that they didn't want to come back, they would weigh him down with stones or break his legs or whatever, just to try and keep him from returning from the afterlife. And I remember reading this passage and thinking, there was a hint of that when we were cremating my father. We were thinking, let's hope he doesn't come back and haunt us. So this poem was actually really inspired by reading that passage in McCulloch and just thinking about my dad again. My father's funeral. We wanted to seal his mouth with a handful of clay, to cover his eyes with the ash of the last bonfire he made at the rainiest edge of the garden. And didn't we think for a moment of crushing his feet so he couldn't return to the house at Halloween to stand at the window, smoking and peering in, the look on his face like that flaw in the sway of the world where mastery fails and the hinge in the mind swings open, grief or terror coming loose and drifting like a leaf into the fire.
Living with your father, John, it seems like in some ways such a typical cliched Scottish story, I guess, of, you know, the violence and the alcoholism and those horrendous times that you had to fight through. Can you talk a bit about what was it that tipped you over the edge to write poetry and perhaps your personal experience of actually falling down to the depths of, you know, drug taking and alcoholism?
Yeah, it's a very familiar story in Scotland. I mean, we even have a name for the tradition. It's Kailyard tradition, kind of father-son conflicts. And often that's about rural, you know, farming families. And, you know, we were from an industrial background, but that was very common among my peers that people had bad relationships with their fathers. But my father was particularly extreme, perhaps. And his approach to parenting me was very much to undermine everything. I remember as a child, he would say to me, you know, before you were born, we had a daughter. Your mother and I had a daughter. And of course, I would know this. And I said, yes, I know. And he said, you know, her name was Elizabeth. I said, yes, I know. And he said, well, you know, she died. I said, yes, I know. And he'd say, I wish it had been you. So, you know, it wasn't really designed to inspire confidence. But my mother, of course, was trying to counter this in much quieter ways. You know, I think it's difficult when you're also afraid of the tension and the violence that somebody's the source of, but you're somehow trying to work against that. So she was always negotiating it and trying to encourage me. And she even got the parish priest involved so I could get a piano to play because he wouldn't let me have a piano. And eventually, I certainly wasted my teenage years and didn't do very well in exams and things because I was just too busy playing up. But I did go to college because my mother wanted me to, and I didn't actually want to go. I kind of wanted to just reject everything. But I did go to college, and that made a difference, I think. And it was a lot longer before I actually started writing. I started writing about in my late 20s. And then I just started writing really as a way of balancing my life, because I started working in the computer industry, and it's all a bit kind of, you know, balancing the left brain, right brain kind of thing, and went on from there, really. on the vanishing of my sister, age 3, 1965. They saw her last in our garden of stones and willows, a few bright twigs and pebbles glazed with rain, and here and there, amidst the dirt and gravel, a slick of leaf and milkstone, beautiful for one long moment in the changing light. Then she was gone. My mother had looked away for a matter of seconds. She said this over and over, as if its logic could undo the wildness of a universe that stayed predictable for years, then carried off a youngest daughter. My father was in the room at the back of our prefab, watching the new TV, the announcer excited, Gold Cup Day, and Arkell romping home by 20 lengths. Maybe we have to look back to see that we have all the makings of bliss, the first spring light, the trees along the farm road thick with song. And surely it was this that drew her out to walk into the big wide world, astonished, suddenly at home no matter where she was. It seems when they found her, she wasn't the least bit scared. An hour passed, then another. My mother waited while our friends and neighbours came and went, my father running out to search, then back again, taking her once in his arms and trying vainly to reassure her, she in her apron, dusted with icing and flour, and he too self-contained, too rudely male, more awkward now than when he knew her first. A marriage come between them, all those years of good intent and blithe misunderstanding. It was Tom Dow who brought her home, tears in his eyes, the boy we'd always known as the local bully, suddenly finding himself heroic. And when they brought her in and sat her down, we gathered to stand in the light of her, life and death inscribed in the blue of her eyes and the sweet confusion of rescue, never having been endangered. She's married now, and Tom is married too, and I, like my father, strayed into discontent, not being what was wanted, strange to myself, and wishing all the time that I was lost, out at the end of winter, turning away to where the dark begins, far in the trees, darkness and recent cold and the sense of another, far in the trees, where no one pretends I belong.
Years on, John, what was it that drove you to write that poem? I mean, you're talking about being the outsider there. But that's something that I love about you and your poetry. You know, you are the unexpected. You're the rule breaker. We don't want you to be the normal the normal bloke in the middle. What was it that, you know, really inspired you to write something like that 50 years on?
Well, I suppose one of the things that we all imagine we're going to do is not repeat the mistakes of our parents or somehow have a better life or a happier life or a more adjusted life or whatever than our parents. And of course, focused as we are on, with the intention of not doing that, we make different mistakes. So I think the poem is reflective. It was reflective of this event really happened exactly as it's told, even to the detail of the racing car that was on that day. And the sense of something can be lost, you know, that the most precious thing in your life can be lost just from one second to the next. And it was a poem that came out of myself having children now, and a poem that comes out of trying to adjust to the long-term pressures and challenges of being married, being a parent, you know, those kinds of things. And hopefully it was a poem that which actually gave me better insight into my parents, because I tend to judge them a little harshly when I was younger.
John, I was looking, I think it was the Scottish Poetry website, and it had John Burnside, date of birth, third line was Catholic. And I thought, you know, you wouldn't find that word on anyone else's biog around the world. I think it's just a very Scottish thing to put. I was almost waiting for the next line to be an Celtic fan or something.
Yeah. But,
so you were obviously brought up as a Catholic, and there's traces of questioning God and the influence of that throughout your work. There's that wonderful line, candy and broken glass go far enough and some hideous God will meet you. And I've been transported, you know, almost to the John Burnside heavenly gates of hell. I don't know. Talk a bit about how Catholicism fuels your work and is in your unconscious or in your thought process.
Yeah, I think the Catholics actually say, you know, give me a boy until he's... They always say boy. They don't say child. They always say boy. Give me a boy until he's 7 years old and I'll make him a Catholic, you know, and no matter what he tries to do afterwards, he'll remain a Catholic somehow. I think that's true. I think Catholic iconography and philosophical questions just remain. And I've not been to a church for many years now, and I wouldn't consider myself a Catholic in any conscious way. I mean, if I was choosing a religious bias or philosophical bent, it would be Taoist. I mean, I think I'm probably more influenced and consciously by things like Lao Tzu and those kinds of books. But the unconscious, the deep part, the kind of Bruegel-flavoured centre of things is still Catholic. You know, those Catholic images just keep on coming back. And I don't mind that. My poetry isn't going to somehow give support to the Catholic Church.
Would you take us into your poem, Faith?
The idea really of Faith was that it was a poem as a movie. I wanted to make a movie, and obviously I can't, but I wanted the images that come out of certain kinds of movies, maybe B-movies from the 50s. The old idea of, you know, the tent show coming through town and all these mysterious characters coming through town and then something happens and which of these mysterious, sinister characters is responsible. And, of course, you know, it's probably none of them. It's probably just some local. There's that lingering feeling of what one means by faith. It takes faith to get up in the morning. It takes faith to kind of go to work and keep on going. And some people do it through faith in a church or a philosophy or family or a set of values. And some people at certain times in their life are perhaps reduced to having to have faith in very, very basic things, you know, the kind of very, very fundamental things. And the character at the center of this poem really is somebody who has got to that level. And because of what's happened to her, she's somebody who has to basically cling on to the very, very shreds of faith. Faith. The tent show had been and gone, and now there was nothing but rust and sunlight, like a poultice on the grass. Candy and broken glass and a spare tatter of hallelujah blown through the dust, where somebody passing through had stopped to write a half-dozen half-formed letters we couldn't decipher, out where the trailers had stood at the edge of the night. And the May Queen was lost for hours before she was missed, her mother asleep after back shift, her father a rumour, a story the woman would tell of a distant summer. Idealised, hazy at best, he had left her one morning at dawn for the Sanskrit of rain. Go far enough, they say, and some hideous god will meet you like a shadow on the road. Go further still, and scripture closes in. A run of sodden fields, an empty street, the last few houses white and incomplete like houses in an early Flemish painting, lamp-lit windows rimmed with soot, a bright canal, and figures skating out to distances where anything could vanish. The woman never hears of them again, the man long gone, the daughter going after. She sits up in the dark and prays for faith, the strength she needs to say they are together. But sometimes when she dreams, she comes upon a scuffed trail in the woods, a beaten track where something killed was dragged and trodden down and hidden in the leaves. Its eyes are blind, and what it clutches in its broken hand is painfully familiar, shreds of black and steel grey, like that overcoat he wore the day he left. She wakes to mourning doves, a hint of blue, thin sunlight on the walls and at her door, a figure she has never seen before, not him, not her, but something of the two combined. And then the shape she glimpsed is gone. No memory of either for a long, still moment as the usual day begins. The unhymned hours of work, the swoop of grief, the moment's pause for utter disbelief. Fresh venom in whatever peace she wins. The random acts of love, the venial sins. Thank you.
What one means by faith is so in that poem, but I'm also intrigued about your questionings about what one means by happiness. And, you know, does happiness exist? And, you know, of course, I always think about that quote from Wittgenstein when he said, "I don't know why we are here, but I'm pretty sure that it's not in order to enjoy ourselves." And I'm trying to debunk it daily. But, let's turn to your poem, Late Show, where you reminisce about watching the Lucille black and white shows and perhaps where everyone ends up happy. What's your take on happiness?
Well, I've also got a book of short stories called Something Like Happy, which is most of them are reflections on how people try to be happy or try to alleviate their unhappiness, maybe. I think we live in a society which kind of expects us to be happy, mostly by consuming stuff, you know, to be happy all the time. Obviously, nobody can be happy all the time. It just doesn't make any sense. If you were happy all the time, you wouldn't have a concept of happiness because you wouldn't have anything to contrast it to. I think what happens is that we rob ourselves of the moments of happiness that we can have by constantly being anxious about why we aren't happy all the time, so that we're not prepared for those little blessings that life occasionally offers us where happiness does happen. I think that's the most important thing for me anyways, is that it's that sense of, you know, happy ever after. Black Cat Bone really was a kind of 60-odd page protest against the idea of, and they all lived happily ever after. Of course they didn't. You know, they got married, for God's sake. They couldn't have possibly lived happily ever after. That's what happens in the old stories. And they got married and they lived happily ever after. And you think, well, yeah, okay. After the honeymoon, what then, you know? So marriage is work, you know, bringing up kids is work. And there's huge joys in all of those things. But there's also pain and compromise and difficulty. And if we fail to recognize those things, we cheat ourselves because we feel disappointed in something that wouldn't have disappointed us if we hadn't had such high expectations, you know, unrealistic expectations of it.
Yes. Would you like to take us? That's why you're on the road for 2 months. It keeps the marriage alive.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. A friend of mine told me that her parents had the perfect marriage, and I said, how did they manage that? And she said, well, he lives in Worcestershire and she lives in Gloucestershire.
Yes. Could you read us Late Show then, and maybe then take us on into the fairy tale ending?
Late Show. I only watch reruns now of films about geese. And yet I'm waiting for the miracle I used to find in early black and white, where everyone looks like us and ends up happy in a place they're learning never to take for granted. In northern Canada, it's summer now, and birds that look like friends I had in school are dancing in a field of moss and thaw. And as I watch, the darkness gathers round me slowly, warmth and quiet in its gift for as long as the birds take flight, or Lucille Ball lights up the screen like someone who's been there forever. As I was saying, Black Cat Bone as a collection really was a kind of protest against the idea of happily ever after. And the fairy tale ending is something that seemed to me so absurd. And yet, you know, people seem to swallow it, seem to go for it. And you see people getting married and expecting, you know, that they're going to have this wonderful fairy tale ending, and buying something, think it's going to make a difference in life, or getting the job that they've always wanted and thinking they're going to be happily ever after. And the fairy tale ending is something that I think actually, as I say, deprives us of other possibilities. So love is something more complex and more difficult, but perhaps more rewarding than the conventions, is the basic argument, I suppose. On the fairy tale ending, begin with the fend for yourself of all the loves you learned about in storybooks. Fish scale and fox print graven on the hand forever, and a tiny hook and eye unfastened in the sweet meat of a heart you thought would never grieve or come undone. May, and already it's autumn. Broken gold and crimson in the medieval beech woods, where our shadows come and go, no darker than the figures in a book of changes. till they're hexed and singled out for something chill and slender in this world, more sleight of hand than sorrow or safekeeping.
I've been asking about happiness for years when I interview people, and I remember at the 2001, I think it was, the Edinburgh Book Festival, and I was interviewing Doris Lessing, and it was going fine, as much as an interview with Doris Lessing could. and I asked her about her theory on happiness and what she sort of believed it might be. She looked at me, "This is ridiculous," and stormed off. The only person that's ever stormed off from one of my interviews.
But she storms off a lot, but she stormed off when she got the Nobel Prize.
Goodness. Goodness.
Well, you know what happened? When she heard she got the Nobel Prize, she said, "Well, I've got to go to Tesco's now." And she went off to the supermarket.
Did she?
that's the story I was told.
Oh, dear. Right, so let's move on to towards an ending.
This is another variation on the Happily Ever After theme. My new book that I've just finished, actually, is coming out next year, is a big riff on romantic love and what our expectations of romantic love are. It's called I Put a Spell on You. And I think, you know, again, it's like that feeling that you meet someone and, you know, something happens and you kind of put a spell on each other and you live in a kind of separate private realm for the rest of your lives. It's interesting that terms like wedlock, you know, and wedlock is a very sinister word to me. Describes the married state, locked, wedded together. It sounds horribly claustrophobic. And people mistake my approach in the book for being, as it were, anti-romantic love or anti-marriage. It's not that. It's more a kind of case of saying, well, you know, these things are more complicated and they're actually more interesting than the storybook versions. So again, this is a poem talking about the possibility of ending, because that's one of the things that we do, is our fantasy is that, you know, and they all lived happily ever after is the end. You don't bother telling the rest of the story because the rest of the story might be a bit messier than that. So this is a kind of different kind of ending, if you like. Notes towards an ending. No more conversations. No more wedlock. No more vein of perfume in a scarf I haven't worn for months. Her voice come back to haunt me, and the Hundertwasser sky magnificat to how a jilted heart refuses what it once mistook for mercy. It's never what we wanted, ever after. We asked for something else, a lifelong Reich of unexpected gifts and dolce vita, peach blossoms smudging the glass and a seasoned glimmer of the old days in this house where every night we tried and failed to mend that feathered thing we brought in from the yard after it came to grief on our picture window.
Everybody needs good neighbors, just a friendly wave each morning helps to make a better day.
The good neighbor. Somewhere along this street, unknown to me, behind a maze of apple trees and stars, he rises in the small hours, finds a book, and settles at a window or a desk to see the morning in. Alone for once, unnamed, unburdened, happy in himself. I don't know who he is. I've never met him walking to the fish house or the bank. And yet I think of him on nights like these, waking alone in my own house, my other neighbors quiet in their beds like drowsing flies. He watches what I watch, tastes what I taste. On winter nights, the snow, in summer, sky. He listens for the bird lines in the clouds, and like that ghost companion in the old explorer's tales, that phantom in the sleet, fifth in a party of four, he's not quite there, but not quite inexistent, nonetheless. And when he lays his book down, checks the hour and fills a kettle, something hooded stops, as cell by cell, a heartbeat at a time, my one good neighbour sets himself aside and alters into someone I have known, a passing stranger on the road to grief, husband and father, rich man, poor man, thief.
I'm not forecasting your death at all, John, here, of course. But what would you write on your tombstone?
I wouldn't have one.
You wouldn't have a tombstone?
No, I will, because my family would have one, but I've always wanted a sky burial. You know, the sky burials where they, you know, you leave the body up in the mountain and the crows and the animals eat it. That's what I'd like to do. This is not my death, it's my father's again. It's called Tod und Verklärung, is the title in German, which means death and transfiguration, of course. There's a great tone poem by Richard Strauss, Death and Transfiguration, where the character is in the process of dying and reflects back on their life and is transfigured by death. And I've always liked the idea of that death is a form of transfiguration, of a change. Again, it's thinking about endings. Death doesn't seem to me to be the ending of anything very much. Maybe my individual consciousness, my socialized, you know, being, but everything else continues. The bones continue, the brain cells die off slowly and becomes matter and all that. You know, I'm not one of these people who believes in something simple like the soul goes to heaven or, you know, you get reborn as a fish or something. But I do believe that something decays slowly and becomes something else, both in terms of matter and in terms of, call it spirit, whatever. But the other thing, of course, is that we also transfigure our dead imaginatively. And this is a poem which is me and my father, as it were, meeting again and me forgiving him. And so this poem is an act of transfiguration of us both, because I transfigure him in the poem into someone that I like. And by doing so, I transfigure myself as well. Tod und Verklärung. My father comes back from the dead, having been transfigured. Now he's a tracker out on the edge of the town, following a line of cloven prints to where the snow begins beyond the pines. He's slower now and careful of the world around him, so there's space enough for me to follow after, nothing to betray or harbour in the knotwork of the heart, and barely a glimmer to show for the fallow deer that frays against the wind till it steps free. No backward glance, no scent, no mere redemption, only a gap in the snow when it slips away.
Obviously, I guess since your father has passed away, you feel what, more comfortable or at peace to write something like that?
Well, he actually died in the 1980s. And in fact, the book I wrote about our relationship, I didn't write until late 90s. People think that one writes a difficult and painful book in which one, as it were, is solving problems or performing some kind of therapy, self-therapy. But for me, I couldn't have written anything until long after he was gone, because I had to come to terms with how I felt. And we always carry, I think, the rest of our lives, we carry little images of our mother and father and perhaps other people as well inside us. They don't die from the inside of our imagination. They're still there. And, you know, it was very urgent for me in a way to transform my own image of my father, the little father that I carried around in my head, especially considering that when my first son was born, I wanted to really come to terms with that little father inside my head, because I was going to be a father myself. I was walking down the street today in Melbourne and I saw that there's a show coming out, The Etta James Story.
Something told me it was over. Yeah. When I saw you and her talking.
I was a huge fan of Etta James. And growing up, you know, we used to listen to her. When I heard that she died, this is kind of one of those little serendipitous things. I was actually marking essays, because I also work in the University of St. Andrews. I teach American poetry. I was marking undergraduate American poetry essays. It so happened that one of the subjects was Frank O'Hara, and quite a few of the students chose to write about Frank O'Hara. And of course, Frank O'Hara has this very famous poem, The Day Lady Died, when Billie Holiday died and when he heard that news. And I literally was marking these papers, and my wife came in and said, oh, do you know Etta James died? All of it was pointing towards writing a poem. So this poem is actually kind of play on the poem by Frank O'Hara, and it's called The Day Etta Died, and so The Day Lady Died. And it's a memory. I changed the names to protect the innocent and the guilty, but it's a memory of when I was back in the old days when I used to go to the Catholic club disco. The Day Etta Died. I was marking a stack of essays on Frank O'Hara, and each had a wiki paragraph to say who Jenny was and who was Billie Holiday. Just as this poem stumbles to its end, predictably remembering the cold December night, I slow danced with Annabel Gray to I'd Rather Go Blind at the Catholic Club Christmas party. Trees lit with frost outside and cherry-coloured street lamps round the playground at Our Lady's. And here and there, on windows dark with soot, are blurred reflections, silent in the glass, yet guiding each other soundlessly into the sway of the future, almost swooning from the close proximity of skin and muddled breathing.
For you are mine at last.
She was a great singer.
Fabulous.
In a tragic life, because she, you know, a great talent, but very self-destructive, terrible upbringing, a lot of abuse and, you know, and drugs, etc. So, you know, a very sad life, but she was also tough. She kept on going, and I love her, you know. Really.
A bit like you, John. You've kept on going, thank goodness.
Yeah, I've got to keep on going. I've got young children, so I've got to keep on going for a lot longer.
Well, thanks so much for joining us. That was fabulous.
Well, thank you.
Cheers, John.
Great. I really enjoyed it.
And in this Poetica podcast from RN, we've been listening to the poetry of John Burnside. The sound engineer was Andrew Hensing, and the program was produced by Fiona Kroll. John's most recent book of poetry is Black Cat Bone, published by Jonathan Cape. For more details, visit the Poetica page on the RN website. And while you're there, you can leave us a comment. In our next podcast, we're presenting a new collection of African women's poetry.